Well, we come to the life of Elisha, part 8. And we have this morning the healing of Naaman. Now, at the end of chapter 4, if you remember, there's a man from Baal, Shalisha, I don't know how you pronounce it, and he comes to Elisha with the first fruits of the barley harvest. Does he go to Baal? No. Does he visit the shrine of the state-controlled religion, the cult of the golden calf? No. He comes to Elisha. Why? Because in Israel, God is to be found with Elisha. That's where his presence is known. That's where his blessing flows. That's where his grace is to be found. Elisha's like a mobile tabernacle, where the grace of God abounds, driving back the curse and restoring the blessing. But does that grace stop at the borders of Israel? What about the pagan Gentiles beyond? Are they beyond hope? Are they beyond redemption? Just how big is God's embrace? And we find the answer in chapter 5 with the healing of Naaman. It's all very New Testament, isn't it? It's a foretaste of the coming day when the good news that Jesus saves will be proclaimed to the ends of the earth. So please have 2 Kings chapter 5 open in front of you. Today we're only going to get as far as verse 19. And to be honest, this is really one message spread over 2 weeks, because some of the things we'll be talking about next week will be from what we're talking about this week. But so far, what we're going to do is we're going to just look at the chapter this morning, open it up, see what it's saying, and then we'll draw 2 lessons, but there'll be more lessons to come. So let's get going. 2 Kings, chapter 5. Let's look at the narrative. Verse 1. Now Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, was a great and honourable man in the eyes of his master, because by him the Lord had given victory to Syria. He was also a mighty man of valour, but a leper. So how do you describe Naaman? He's valiant, powerful, successful, triumphant. He's loved by his king, adored by his people, feared by his enemies. And as you read at least the first part of verse 1, we find ourselves looking up, don't we? Sort of stretching, craning our necks. This man is possessed with greatness. He strides the national or the international stage like a colossus. And we find ourselves looking up and up and up at the greatness of this man until we come to the very last word of the verse. Leper. Naaman is about as great as the world can make him, and yet for all that, disease and uncleanness flow through his veins. He was also a mighty man of valour, but a leper. Now, when we think about leprosy, we think about something called Hansen's disease. But the Bible's word for a leper covers a range of disfiguring skin diseases. So we don't actually know which disease Naaman had, other than, verse 27, because it's given to Gehazi, its appearance was as snow. So maybe that speaks about its flakiness. Maybe it speaks about the whiteness of the crust. We don't know. It's rather unpleasant to think about, isn't it? Whatever it was enough to excite the pity of those around him. Now, about 25 or so years ago, it's probably safe to say it now, I taught a boy by the name of Edgar Scrace. And as you do sometimes when you're teaching a teacher and you have someone with an unusual name, you joke to yourself. I never say it to him, but I used to joke to myself, "Oh, Edgar, you're a disgrace." As he was quite a nice lad. But I used to joke to myself quite often, "Edgar, you're a disgrace." Edgar, anyway, it came to the parents' evening. And having joked to myself, "Edgar, you're a disgrace," I thought, when it comes to the parents' evening, I mustn't use the word disgrace. Well, I got through the parents' evening without uttering the word disgrace. And then almost the last parents I had to see were Mr. and Mrs. Scrace. And as they approached me, I was saying to myself, "I mustn't say disgrace. I mustn't say disgrace." And within 30 seconds of talking to them, I said, "Edgar's writing is a disgrace." And I'm like, "Oh, no, I've said it." The point is this: when you try not to think about something, somehow you can't avoid it, can you? And if you've met Naaman, try as you might not to think that he's a leper, this great man standing before you in all his finery and glory, somehow you couldn't avoid focusing on his leprosy. In spite of his greatness, in spite of everything else you might see about him, his leprosy is his defining quality. But things are about to change. They start in verse 2 in Israel with a personal tragedy. A little girl from a godly home is kidnapped by a band of Syrian raiders. And she ends up serving Naaman's wife. Verse 3, she said to her mistress, "If only my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria, for he would heal him of his leprosy." She's just an unknown, unnamed slave girl who refuses to forget her God, who refuses to give in to bitterness, whose heart is soft towards her master. Little slave girl. It's a very small hinge, isn't it? But a big door is about to turn upon it. If only my master was with Elisha. Well, wife talks to husband. Darling, it must be worth a try. So verse 4, Naaman goes and talks it over with the king. And he says, verse 5, go. And so he does. With a letter to smooth the way and a gift to secure the services of the healer. And it's a massive gift, verse 5. So he departed and took with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothing. That's huge. It is about 340 kilograms of silver. That's about 53 stone. And 90 kilograms of gold. That's about 14 stone. It's a huge gift, isn't it? 53 stone of silver, 14 stone of gold. Well, verse 6, he arrives at the court of the king of Israel with this letter. Now be advised, when this letter comes to you, that I have sent Naaman, my servant, to you, that you may heal him of his leprosy. How does the king of Israel respond? Well, far from helping the situation, he actually stands in the way. Instead of helping Naaman out of his skin, all the king of Israel seems concerned about is saving his own skin. Instead of pointing him to the man of God, he says, "What can I do?" Verse 7. And it happened when the king of Israel read the letter that he tore his clothes and said, "Am I God to kill and make alive, that this man sends a man to me to heal him of his leprosy? Therefore, please consider and see how he seeks a quarrel with me." This is all a plot, just an excuse for war. But verse 8, Elisha gets word, and he says to the king, "Even if you, the king, don't know that there's a prophet in Israel, this foreigner, this Naaman, will." So verse 9, Naaman and his entourage travel to Elisha's house. Can you see the scene? Think about it in your mind's eye. This great Syrian general, national hero, all his finery and splendor, his retinue of servants, his personal bodyguard, his great war chariot, his war horses. Imagine, like Barack Obama coming to your door. Naaman steps down from his chariot in all his pomp, and he stands at the door of Elisha's house, waiting for Elisha to come out to him. But Elisha's nowhere to be seen. There's not even a voice from inside saying, "Well, begging your pardon, I'll be with you in a moment." Instead, a messenger appears with an unadorned message. Verse 10. "Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored to you, and you shall be clean." And Naaman's incensed. Who does this little man think he is? Verse 11. "But Naaman became furious and went away and said, 'Indeed, I said to myself, he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and heal the leprosy. Are not the Abana and the Pharpar The rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in one of them and be clean? So he turned and went away in a rage. You see what he's saying, can't you? I've come all this way. The least he could do is to get up, walk a few paces, come out of his house and come out to me. Doesn't he know who I am? And as for this remedy, I thought he'd stand before me, wave his hand, call upon his God. Yes, all this great man has to do is stand, and Elisha and God himself will come. And as for the muddy Jordan, when Syria is famed for the pure, cool, liquid crystal of the rivers that flow through it, I've never been so insulted. So he turned and went away in a rage. Fancy. Elisha doesn't treat this great man as a great man. He treats him, like a leper. Without rights, without anything to recommend him, without anything to bargain with, Elisha treats this great man like a leper. Not very seeker sensitive, is it? And for Naaman, who's come all this way, this is a step too far. It's too humiliating. It's all too simple. And frankly, it's too ridiculous. So he storms off. Well, even if Naaman is determined to stand in the way of his own healing, his servants are not. And I hope as we go through this, you see there's a lot of language of master-servant. People keep standing before other people. We'll think about that next week. It's all very significant as you go through the passage. And then what do the servants say to him? The servants came near and spoke to him and said, "My father, if the prophet had told you to do something great, would you not have done it? How much more then when he says to you, 'Wash and be clean'?" They have the measure of their master, don't they? They know that his pride has been stung. And their soft answer turns away Naaman's wrath. And hence we read verse 14. He went down and dipped 7 times in the Jordan according to the saying of the man of God. And his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child. And he was clean. The word dip here means actually to dip. To go under. Naaman has to take off his honours. Has to strip off his clothes. Has to be exposed for what he really is. A naked, unclean leper. He must abandon his greatness. He must confront his shame. He must go down. This is an act of abasement. He's got to go down under the water. And not just once, not sort of quick in and out and hope no one was watching. He's got to do it 7 times. Because it will take 7 times. 7 times to humble himself before God. 7 times to lose more than his leprosy. 7 times to surrender himself to the God of Israel. 7 times to submit completely, utterly, totally to the voice of God. 7 times to become poor in spirit. It's not God who comes running when Naaman clicks his fingers. It's Naaman who must go down before God. The mighty commander must become as a little helpless child, dependent utterly upon the God who is rich in mercy. He went down, dipped 7 times in the Jordan, according to the saying of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. It's wonderful, isn't it? The unclean is made clean. Do you see now why Elisha refuses to come when Naaman calls? Had Elisha come out to him and performed the healing as he demanded, Well, in his own eyes, Naaman would have remained the master. I am the master. Elijah comes and stands before me. He does what he's supposed to do. He's the healer. He'd be able to keep his pride, wouldn't he? It's all been done his way, to his satisfaction, to his pleasure. But by Elisha staying put and simply sending a messenger, Naaman is compelled to have dealings with God himself. It's not going to be an intermediary. It's direct dealings with God. He's made to see that he really is a helpless, unclean leper, dependent upon the grace of God. Well, look at verse 15. This is now a very different Naaman, isn't it? And he returned to the man of God, he and all his aides, and came and stood before him. And he said, "Indeed, now I know there is no God in all the earth except in Israel." That's extraordinary, isn't it? He's not one God among the many. He's not even the greatest God amongst all the other gods. Naaman, this pagan, says the Lord is the only God. There's no God in all the earth except in Israel. Naaman's been converted. A pagan, an ex-pagan, confessing the Lord. It's all very New Testament, isn't it? You think of when Paul writes to the Thessalonians, and he says to them, "How you turned to God from idols to serve the true and living God." It happened to them. It's happened here to Naaman. And with his new confession comes a new humility, doesn't it? Look at verse 15 again. He says, "Now therefore, please take a gift from your servant." So the man who clicked his fingers and expected Elisha to come and stand before him now calls himself Elisha's servant. It's a new humility. "Well, take a gift from your servant." And what does Elisha say? "As the Lord lives before whom I stand, I will receive nothing." And he urged him to take it, but he refused. Why? Why doesn't Elisha at least take some of this great gift? Because this young believer, Naaman, must be clear in this. The God's grace, the grace that has made him clean, the grace that has saved him, it can't be bought and it can't be bribed. Salvation is free. God has met the whole cost of Naaman's salvation himself. It's been put to all God's expense. And therefore, Naaman, you've got to see that your healing is a gift. You can give nothing for it. It's a gift of God. It's all of grace, all of God's wonderful kindness, his free, extravagant, overflowing love towards an undeserving, helpless, guilty, wretched leper. There must be no misunderstanding. This is God's doing from beginning to end. What's his name in verse 17? "If you won't take my silver and gold, can I take 2 mule loads of earth? Then if not, please let your servant be given 2 mule loads of earth, for your servant will no longer offer either burnt offering or sacrifice to other gods, but to the Lord." He wants to meet with God. He wants to keep a regular appointment where he can come and worship. He desires a relationship. The Lord has his heart, and he wants to worship him. "So let me take some of the holy ground of Israel back to Syria, where I can meet the holy God of Israel." Do you see what's happened to him? The dust of the Holy Land is now to him of more worth, more value than all the treasures of Syria. And we understand, don't we, something of Naaman's spirit. The psalmist says, "For a day in your courts is better than 1,000. And I would rather be a doorkeeper in the house of my God than dwell in the tents of wickedness." So Naaman's been saved. He confesses the Lord, he repents of all other gods, he desires a relationship, he wants to worship him, he wants to meet with him, adore him, love him, walk with him. And like a new convert, his conscience is tender. Verse 18. "Yet in this thing may the Lord pardon your servant. When my master goes into the temple of Rimmon to worship there, and he leans on my hand, and I bow down in the temple of Rimmon, when I bow down in the temple of Rimmon, may the Lord please pardon your servant in this thing." Yes, he won't worship the storm god Rimmon, Only when his master bows down, and he's at his master's side, he's got to show support to his master. He's not going to be bowing down to Rimmon, but to show support to his master. When his master bows down, then he will accompany him. Is that okay? Can I do that, Elisha? And you see already Naaman is light years ahead of the compromised Israelites. But is it okay to bow down in the temple of Rimmon? Not to Rimmon, but just to show my allegiance, my solidarity with my master. What answer would you give? I want to talk over lunch, isn't it? What answer would you give? Well, Elisha knows that Naaman's question shows that his heart really is new. And his loyalty really is to the Lord. If his loyalty wasn't to the Lord, he wouldn't be feeling the conflict. And then he says, therefore he says, verse 19, go in peace. And he departed from him a short distance. Well, that's just opening up the passage. We'll close with two lessons. And as I say, God willing, next week we'll pick up another lesson from this passage as we look at the rest and the remainder of the chapter. But two lessons for now. Lesson number one is this. It's the sovereignty of God. What's the sovereignty of God? Well, simply this, that God is in control. How far does God's control extend? Says the Bible, God's control extends over everything. So here's the mighty Naaman. He's a national hero. But to who do we attribute his success? Verse 1, now Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, was a great and honourable man in the eyes of his master. Why? Because by him the Lord had given victory to Syria. So who's in control of Syrian politics? Who's in control of Syrian foreign affairs? It's the Lord. So, Christian friends, the United Kingdom, who's running the country? In whose hand is the outcome of the election? Who regulates Parliament? And the answer is, the Lord. You don't think he'd leave them unsupervised, do you? But if God is in charge of the big stuff, he's also sovereign over the small stuff. Naaman is converted. Where does it begin? With a little servant girl. Verse 3, she said to her mistress, if only my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria, for he would heal him of his leprosy. And so often that's God's way. God is so often not with the headlines, not with the noise. In God's economy, the big doors so often turn upon small hinges. In the terrorist attacks on the Twin Towers, 9/11, who lived and who died often came down to trivial things. The man who was late that morning because he took his son for his first day at the kindergarten. Or the man who lived because it was his turn to go out and get the donuts. Or the man that morning who put on a new pair of shoes, got a blister, and stopped off on his way to work at a chemist to buy a plaster. And that delayed him and saved his life. A blister saved his life. Then she said to her mistress. So often God's ways are that big doors turn on small hinges. I found that was put to the test on Thursday. I was taking a family funeral. And on the way there, I left with plenty of time because you don't know what might happen. But on the way there, I was stuck in a traffic jam. It was a big traffic jam because the air ambulance was involved. And for an hour, I sat completely stationary. No one was moving. We all got out of our cars and wandered around. Nothing was happening. We were stuck. And I thought about this passage. The God who has purpose in all things. And the knowledge of this passage, sitting there at that hour, kept me calm. I arrived at the crematorium late. And the providence of God, the next 30-minute slot was free. And so all was well. So the next time you get stuck in a traffic jam, or something trivial upsets your plans, or you're the one sent out to get the donuts, just remember who is in control. That's where God wants you to be at that very moment. There's purpose in it. Some of our friends are stuck overseas because there are no aircraft flying. So you can text them, email them. You are where God wants you to be at this very moment. Our plans are frequently upset. Things don't turn out as we expected, thought, decided, deliberated upon. But that's because God is sovereign. And he is in control. And there is purpose in it. But I want to take this a step further. That little girl, her vibrant testimony. If only my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria, he would heal him of his leprosy. What a wonderful providence that she's there. What a blessing to Naaman. And through her testimony, he gets saved. But think about it. Because verse 3 comes after verse 2, doesn't it? And the Syrians had gone out on raids and had brought back captive a young girl from the land of Israel. She waited on Naaman's wife. A young girl. What was it like that day when the Syrians came? To be snatched from her family. I wonder, did they kill her parents? It's obviously a godly home, isn't it? Because she points to Elisha. She believes that God is with Elisha. God is at work in Israel through his prophet. It's obviously a godly home. It's a believing home. She's a young girl snatched from a believing home. To be taken away forever. She's not gone there for a few weeks or a few months or a few years. She is now a slave girl in a foreign land forever. Do you dream? What do you dream about? Maybe some of you younger girls, you have your dreams, don't you? What do you dream about? Well, that day all her dreams came to an end. This is a tragedy, isn't it, for this girl? Absolute tragedy. And yet the Lord is in it. Because how else will Naaman hear? Now, Christian friend, think about that. Do you pray, oh Lord, make me useful? Lord, I want to be used in the blessing of others. Lord, take my life, use it, use me for the conversion of others. But what if the Lord's answer to your prayers is personal tragedy and heartache? How do you react to that? What if to bring blessing to another, even salvation to another, it means for you personal tragedy? Because that's what it meant for this little girl, didn't it? How do you react? How does she react? She refuses to forget the Lord. She refuses to blame God. She refuses to become bitter. She has a servant heart. And having experienced grief herself, she recognizes grief in others and has compassion. And she's ready to speak a word for the Lord and what glory he receives. Are you willing, Christian friend, to be used like that? You say, oh Lord, use me in the salvation of others. Make me useful in your kingdom. But what if the Lord is to use you through your own personal tragedy? Christian friend, maybe there's been a grievous providence. Maybe something that's gone back years. Maybe something that's more recent. And maybe this little girl just put the key in your hand so you can escape from your prison of bitterness and blame. God was in it all the time. God is working out his purposes. As he used her, he'll use you in your grief, in your tragedy, in your upset, in a way that will do others good and bring glory to himself. a pastor suffered a complete breakdown, and he ended up in a psychiatric hospital. And he was folding sheets with another patient when came the question that he'd been dreading, or the words that he'd been dreading. And this other patient asked him, he said, "What did you do before you came in here?" And he thought, this is a terrible witness. I'm going to have to tell him that I was a pastor, I was a Bible preacher and teacher. What sort of witness is that, that I should be here doing this? But he had to be honest. He said, "Well, I was a pastor of a church. I taught the Bible." And the other man was absolutely thrilled. He said, "I've got so many questions to ask you." And the pastor realized in that moment that actually it was God who had sent him into that mental institution. Because how else would this man that he's folding sheets with, how else would he hear of the wonders of the gospel of a Jesus that saves to the uttermost? And God so often brings blessings to others through our dark providences and our personal tragedies. So Christian friend, are you willing to be used like that? It's not what I might choose, but then it's God who is all wise. And working it for their good, he'll certainly work it for your good and for his glory. We just close this lesson on this point. Here's a house proud lady. She keeps a beautiful house. But every month, a dirty, stinking, filthy man comes knocking at her door. When she sees him come along through the gate, down the path, she doesn't hide. She doesn't pretend she's not in. She doesn't panic. When he knocks at the door, when he comes calling, she opens the door, she lets him in, she brings him in, she sits him in the front room, she makes him a cup of tea and a slice of cake, and they sit down together. Why? Because that man, appalling to look at, always leaves behind a wonderful gift. A gift of great value, bringing blessing to her and to others. So Christian friends, if we call that man a dark providence, don't be afraid when he comes calling at your door. Because he brings with him a gift from God, a gift for you, but also a gift for the blessing of others. Okay, much more quickly now. Point number two, lesson number two, the salvation of God. Naaman saved. Abandons his gods, doesn't he, to worship the true God. It's wonderful. Just read it again and again. It's thrilling. He's not just clean on the outside, he's clean on the inside, isn't he? He's saved. My friend, this morning, you sit here amongst God's people. You may have grown up in a Christian home. You may have moved in Christian circles for many, many years. The question is, are you saved? Why not? Is it because you don't see yourself as a leper? What was Naaman's Facebook profile? Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Assyria, a great and honorable man, also a mighty man of valor. That's his Facebook profile. That's what he wants the world to see. But I wonder if there are any pictures of him on Facebook. What was it that he didn't want people to see? It was the very thing that defined him, wasn't it? That he was a leper. That's his defining quality. He's a leper. So what's your Facebook profile? You want the world to see that. What is it that you don't want us to see? Your defining quality, says the Bible, is that you are a spiritual leper, which is why you're under a death sentence. You're a sinner. You're unclean before God. Well, what's a sinner? A sinner is what you see in verse 11. But Naaman became furious and went away and said, indeed, I said to myself, he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and heal the leprosy. That's what a sinner is. That's what you are. What do sinners do? Sinners stand still. And they expect the world to come to them. They expect even God to come running. They expect the world to revolve around them. All I need to do is stand still and everything will revolve around me. It's me, 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 me. That's what you are, isn't it? Most of your decisions, most of what you do, you stand still and expect people to come to you. You're an unclean leper. Have you seen it? Are you saved? Why not? Is it all too humiliating? Verse 10, Elisha sent a messenger to him saying, go and wash in the Jordan 7 times and your flesh shall be restored to you and you shall be clean. And that's the problem, is it? God speaks to you as though you are a sinner. Without rights, without bargaining power, with nothing to recommend you to him. You just got to face up to your filthiness, your guilt, and your shame. And you've got to humble yourself before him. You've got to go down. You've got to bow the knee. And it's humiliating, isn't it? And you won't. Are you saved? Why not? It's because it's all too simple. Verse 13. The servants come. My father, if the prophet had told you to do something great, would you not have done it? How much more then when he says to you, wash and be clean? Just to take God at his word? Just to cry, God, be merciful to me, a sinner? Just to fall upon his kind arms? And you think to yourself, well, anyone can do that. And that's the point. And if anyone can do that, then so can you. Salvation is a gift to be received. It's so simple a child can receive God's salvation. Are you saved? Why not? Is it because it's all too narrow? Are not the Abana and the Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Can I not wash in them and be clean? And you keep saying to yourself, well, is there another way? And God says, no. There is no other way. Either you come to Jesus Christ and live, or you walk away and die. Naaman's got a choice. He either goes in the Jordan and is made clean, he walks away and he lives and dies a leper. It's the same choice before you. Either come to Christ and live, walk away and die. It's either heaven or hell. Nor is there salvation found in any other, for there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. Are you saved? Why not? Is it because it's too ridiculous? How can the Jordan River make a leper clean? Tell you something even more ridiculous. How can the Son of God, nailed to a cross 2,000 years ago, shedding his blood, how can he make a sinner clean? But the blood of Jesus goes on, cleansing sinners from their sins. So why aren't you saved this morning? Have you seen yourself as the leper that you really are, unclean before God? Are you ready to humble yourself, to bow the knee? Are you ready to take God at his word and to embrace the only Savior there is, Jesus Christ? Lord, save me, forgive me, wash me, change me. What are you going to do? What did Naaman do? Did he do the right thing? I'm asking you, did he do the right thing? Did Naaman do the right thing? Did he have any regrets? Did he do the right thing? The same choice lies before you. You can walk away and perish, or you can wash and be cleaned.